You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I'm from a generation that doesn't tell Africa what to do, how the rule of law should work.
President Emmanuel Macron is not the first French president to tell Africa that things will be different from now on. Will he be the first to be believed? My guests John Everard and Florence Biedermann will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the attempted murder of a German mayor by an anti-immigration assailant. Does it hint at a wider, deeper anger? The inexorable increase of Japanese data fiddling scandals to a number which looks beyond coincidental, and should New Zealanders object to New Zealander broadcasters speaking New Zealand's indigenous language? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Florence Biedermann, London Bureau Chief for Agence France-Presse, and John Everard, former UK ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the brisk tour of West Africa presently being undertaken by French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron is visiting Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast and Ghana, two of which, Burkina Faso and Ivory Coast, are former French colonies in which French troops are presently stationed. Macron, speaking at the University of Ouagadougou, sought to outline a new approach to West Africa, declaring that he represents a generation that would not tell Africans what to do. Florence, there were, of course, a couple of incidents during the early stages of his visit. A grenade was tossed at some French soldiers before he arrived, missed them but injured some civilians. Rocks were thrown at a vehicle in the general entourage. Why the equivocal welcome?
Well, because the relation with France has always been equivocal from any West African country, and especially in Burkina, because there is history behind. 30 years ago, a young, charismatic and enthusiastic young leader, Thomas Sankara, who wanted to change the relation with France, was murdered by his deputy. And there are still some suspicion that France had a role in this killing. And So, for many years, this has been looming in the relation between the two countries. So now, what is new with Macron is that he announced he would declassify all the documents around this sad affair. So maybe that will be kind of a new start.
You met Sankara, you were telling us, just before we went to air. How large a figure is he in Burkinabe history?
He's kind of this very charismatic, idealistic, and also extremist young leader. You could compare him to kind of Che Guevara, this mythic figure, because he didn't stay long in power. So he didn't have, in any case, time enough like to prove what kind of a statesman he is. So he just stayed as an idealized leader.
John, looking at this trip from a diplomat's point of view, does President Macron have ground to make up? There was, of course, a gaffe in July when he was quoted as saying that Africa had civilizational problems. He was trying, I think, to make a point about the burden of large families, but that reminds Mark was lit upon and he was beaten quite soundly with it.
Well, that's right. An unfortunate gaffe. But I think the main area of ground he's got to make up is the fact that he's French. I mean, round and round we go. I'm trying to remember when we last had a president of France who didn't at some point talk about resetting relations with Africa. It's a kind of like...
That's a ritual, you're right.
It's a ritual, that's right. The France's problem with Africa is that it's like the man riding the elephant. It's fine, provided you keep going as you are. When you try and get off, it's a little bit difficult. You're so deeply enmeshed. Your companies are so, frankly, making so much money out of a lot of African countries. And you have a kind of interdependency that is very, very difficult to shift. So, fine, I admire the rhetoric, a fresh start for France and Africa. I'd love to know how he's actually going to go and do it.
Well, indeed, Florence, he's spoken about Africa being a priority of French economic diplomacy, which is a phrase I have read back and forth several times now. I'm not really sure what it actually means. Are you?
Well, that means that we will, I mean, the big companies will stay as present as they are. So I agree completely with John. I mean, it's a ritual for every new French president to say enough with France-Afrique, meaning enough with that kind of relation where you would support any dictator, where you would be ready to support also corruption by French companies. So that's what Sarkozy said, that's what Hollande said, that's what he says now. And indeed, he doesn't want to really change completely the relation in the sense that we have also this very important military presence. So I think it's more a question of maybe of style and of acknowledgement of what these countries mean for France, like meaning maybe a more equal partnership. But again, this is what every French president says when he arrives in power.
I mean, all colonial powers or former colonial powers have a, I mean, it's always going to be a difficult relationship with their former colonies. But having obviously come from France and spent a lot of time in Britain, does it strike you that they're different relationships that France has with its former colonies to what Britain has with its former colonies? Or is it basically the same thing?
I think it's a vast subject. It's a bit difficult to understand. I think they are always tricky, as you say. I mean, this is a past that is difficult to overcome. They have common problem in this sense. After that, the policy, I mean, it's not that France has a global policy towards South Africa. After that, it's a case-by-case policy.
John, if you are a diplomat or attempting to behave as a diplomat in a country which the country you represent formally occupied or colonised, how much more difficult does that make the job?
It varies enormously. In the UK case, just as in France, it's case by case. In a lot of countries, including in Africa, the UK is regarded with some fondness. I mean, it's not what the liberation rhetoric tells you, but amongst your ordinary people, amongst decision makers now.
But the most ardent Anglophiles I have ever met are the people of the putative Republic of Southern Cameroon, the Anglophile provinces of that country.
Yes, indeed. That's a good example, but other communities in Africa are not far behind. On the other hand, you do come across countries where, you know, there's real anger against the colonial period. It varies enormously. It can be a huge asset, it can be a huge disadvantage. Going back to your point just now, I think case by case, both on the British and on the French ex-colonial side. But in general, I think there's a feeling amongst former British colonies that, you know, they were sort of cut loose and let to go their own way in a much more definite way than ever happened in the previous French Africa. And it's noticeable that whereas former French colonies still now blame France for all kind of things that go wrong, that's become much more muted in countries like Nigeria and Ghana. You know, after several decades of real independence, I think they're much more reluctant to beat that drum.
Just a final question on this one, Florence. There are about 4,000 French troops across the Sahel region, not just in Burkina Faso and Côte d'Ivoire, but also in Chad, Mali and elsewhere. That is a fairly substantial commitment. Is that deployment controversial in France?
No, it's not controversial at all. I mean, especially with after all the jihadist attack in France. I mean, it has been controversial in the past, maybe, but nowadays it's really seen as a presence that can prevent the spread of jihadism, that can also maybe intervene in the migration problem. So definitely no, it's not.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Germany, where a city mayor appears to have been the victim of a politically motivated assassination attempt. Andreas Hallstein, the mayor of Altena in North Rhine-Westphalia, was stabbed in the neck in a kebab shop. Witnesses quoted by German media reported that Mr. Hallstein's assailant made exclamations about the mayor's attitude to immigration. Mr. Hallstein, who seems to have survived thanks to the intervention of the kebab shop proprietor, Demir Abdullah, and his son, is a member of the Christian Democratic Union of Chancellor Angela Merkel and embraced her generous policy towards migrants and asylum seekers. Mayor Hallstein, John, is doing fine, which is obviously excellent news. Well, fine, all things considered. Witnesses also report that the assailant may have had a few. Can we read really that much into this if one angry drunk loses his temper and attempts to do injury to a public official? Does it really speak for a cohort of his people?
Sadly, yes, it does. Not only had he had a few, as you say, he was 56 years old. This was not a young man on the rampage. This was a mature adult who nevertheless felt the need to go for a mayor with a 30-centimetre knife, shouting at the time slogans that indicated he was not in entire agreement with current immigration policy. I think you see this in much better context if you look through the Twitter feed after Angela Merkel's remark expressing horror at the killing and thanks to those who came to the mayor's help.
A model of rational, reasonable discourse, was it?
Tragically, not.
You surprised me.
I can see the surprise on all of your face, Andrew. No, but lots and lots of tweets saying, where was the Chancellor when Muslims knifed Germans? And a cartoon has been put up showing Merkel saying, it's okay, these people didn't actually kill any people, they only killed Germans. There's real anger under the surface there. And this kind of act, completely unforgivable though it is, does express real frustration in Germany.
I mean, from a British point of view, Florence, there's obvious memory stirred up here of the murder of Joe Cox MP during the Brexit referendum campaign by somebody who appears to have had similar motivations to Mr. Holstein's assailant. But Altena, the city of which he is a mayor, has been regarded as a model for the way it has handled migrants. It's tried to house people in normal apartments rather than sequester them in hostels and so forth. It has done all the correct, proper, progressive things. Did Angela Merkel, I mean, is she still underestimating public anger about this?
No, still she doesn't. She saw that in the recent election where she didn't score as well as she thought she would. And everybody noticed like the score of the extreme right and the fact that migration really played an important role. So in the meantime, she has scaled down her policy of welcoming migrants, but it will still stay in the country.
I mean, John, when a politician, any politician, is addressing an issue like this, well, addressing this issue in particular, how mindful should they be not merely of objections, because obviously there's perfectly reasonable, rational, logistical objections you can make to the prospect of having to take in a large number of people very quickly, but obviously a lot of the objections to immigrants are that, you know, they don't come from a good or rational or constructive place, but they're there. How mindful should any politician be about worrying basically about what angry, hate-filled cranks actually think?
I think you need to be really quite concerned about this. I'm not sure that I'd use the verb think. It's more feel, isn't it?
Feel is a better word, yes.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, this isn't an intellectual response. It comes from deep in the gut. You can deplore it, I think, you know, any of us here would condemn this killing out of hand. But there's no doubting the depth of feeling. And unless you do something about that feeling, unless you come to terms with it, unless perhaps you make rather more stringent efforts than Germany has so far about changing the way that people feel about migrants, this kind of thing is going to happen again. And less violently, we're going to see further advances by AfD, who after all just got 94 seats in Parliament.
Florence, you mentioned the last election, and so did John there, with specific reference to the eruption of Alternative for Deutschland, who did come from nowhere to hold 94 seats in the Bundestag. Is that solely a product of Angela Merkel's generosity a couple of summers ago?
That's the most obvious answer I find to it. As you could see, like the rise of Marine Le Pen in the French election, I mean, this was not the only country where that kind of populist extreme right movement has progressed during recent election. So, yes, to me, it seems to be mostly linked to that.
But in staying with the French example, do you get the sense that some of the air has gone out of the Front National and Marine Le Pen or not?
Yeah, she's in trouble, her party's in trouble, one of her most brilliant deputies left, so the party itself is not in such a good shape, but the feelings of the people, what it represents and the people who voted for this party still exist, so it doesn't solve the problem because the party is not up to what the voters could expect, that it would rebound and then be still very present in French politics. Plus, it didn't have many seats in parliament, so it really lost in influence, but I would say its ideas still stay in the air.
Because there's a strange political calculation here, isn't there, John? I think if we look back to the Brexit referendum here in 2016, that when everything else was stripped away, that was basically, I think, a referendum on the free movement of people, which clearly large numbers of people in Britain don't like. Is there an argument that it is a mistake to impose free movement of people when there is such feeling against it, even if the feeling against it isn't necessarily rational or even terribly, you know, generous or pleasant?
I think you can make a case for that. It's not one that I'd endorse, but there is a rational case for it. I think you can make a stronger case for soft peddling, for going easy, for introducing free movement much more gradually than was in fact done, and doing a lot more preparation of the way that people feel about their neighbours and about the right of other people to come and work in their country than was ever done. We talked about Germany, we talked about the UK. This is happening across Europe. Look at Hungary, look at Poland, look at the Czech Republic now. I mean, everywhere there is this reaction against immigration, against the free movement of people. We have to take account of it.
We also need to look at the wider picture of German politics at the moment, Florence. This is the idea of the Grand Coalition, which may be back on, though they're now saying that talks are probably unlikely until the new year. Is this going to happen? It would be an extraordinary about-face by Martin Schulz and the SPD, wouldn't it?
Well, I look in my crystal ball and I don't have, you know, in politics you never have definitive answer. But what is really surprising and comforting in a way for Europe, for the stability of Europe, if you see it this way, is that, yes, I mean, the Grand Coalition is back. And yes, it's a surprise because Martin Schulz has been kind of humiliating by the results of the recent election. So that means back to the German model, like compromising, discussing, which is, again, in a way comforting.
John, is there, I mean, would Martin Schulz and the SPD be feeling under the pressure to, I guess, help restore what Florence was talking about there, the idea of Germany as the one country and indeed possibly the one thing in Europe you can actually rely on?
That might be part of their thinking. Right now, I think it's just a scramble to get the numbers together into a workable coalition. I mean, Schulz, of course, said no right at the outset, but he's been lent on so heavily by everybody, from the Bundespräsident down, including very senior members of his own party, that I don't think he's going to be
The president is one of the senior members of his own party.
Yes, what a coincidence. but I don't see he's got much of a choice than to go along with this. And I think the chances of a grand coalition are looking quite strong.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with John Everard and Florence Biedemann. Coming up next, another Japanese company gets caught cooking its data.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Mullister, with me are John Everard and Florence Biedemann. Now, the spectacle of abject executives bowing in apology has become a recurring spectacle. Spectacle is what I've done there. The spectacle is a recurring spectacle. So not merely is the spectacle recurring, so is my use of the word spectacle. That is some poor...
A spectacular recurrence.
That is some poor script writing.
Andrew.
But anyway, the point stands. In Japan in recent months, as a series of corporations has been found out fiddling various quality-related data. The latest to submit to this supplication are the senior brass of Toray Industries, the world's largest manufacturer of carbon fibre, a subsidiary of which Toray Hybrid Cord Inc. has been rumbled taking liberties with their quality assurance figures. John, this does follow compliance scandals of a similar stripe at Kobe, Subaru, Mitsubishi, Nissan, etc.
beginning to form the impression that this is fairly widespread?
Well, yes, I think one is driven to that conclusion, is one not? I mean, these are some of the biggest names in Japanese industry, people that Japanese and foreigners have always looked up to as hallmarks of quality, reliability, and so on. And look what you find when you strip below the surface. Now, there's a snowball effect here, clearly. I mean, Toyo said that one of the reasons they came clean was because of the pressure they felt from the Mitsubishi revelations. Mitsubishi Materials, of course, are a competitor to them in many ways. But it does leave you wondering how many others are now going to step up and say, actually, we fiddled our accounts too, and what the reaction is going to be. Look at it politically. Abe has just won a stonking great electoral victory.
Indeed.
These are his core supporters. These are the right-of-centre industrialists who bankroll him and who will vote for him en masse. He is not going to go for their throats. At the same time, he's got to protect the reputation of Japan. I suspect that we will see some quite agonised discussions in the Diet over this. I suspect that there will be something of an overhaul in the inspection regime in Japan, but I wonder whether even that is going to be enough.
Florence, the thing I don't understand about this, actually there's quite a lot I don't understand about this, but the thing I really don't understand about this is that Japanese produce has become, in the last few decades especially, an absolute byword for reliability, for being well-made, well-built, and with good reason. So that being the case, why is it necessary to cook the statistics?
I don't know. You should also ask that to Volkswagen, speaking about brands that
Fair
have been
point.
Like reliable cars, the German manufacturing industry. I think in many companies, I wouldn't say all, of course, I'm not blaming everyone, but the kind of tension between the production, the profit and the norms can lead to such results, not only in Japan.
Is it more, is it less about what they actually produce than the corporate culture producing it? Is what we're witnessing here, John, one of those regimes where everybody's so terrified of actually attempting to say to somebody superior to them, I think there's a problem here, that they will just contrive to make the problem look like it doesn't exist?
There may be elements of that, but the immediate trigger, according to those who have now been identified as perpetrating this fraud, was not so much corporate culture as corporate pressure. They said that they were under such intense pressure to hit their targets, and they knew they were going to miss those targets if they admitted that there were faults in the materials, that they fiddled. This is not a purely Japanese phenomenon, of course. Florence has just reminded us of Volkswagen. There are other examples elsewhere. Maybe what we're looking at is a bit of rot in the whole soul of capitalism.
Does it damage the reputation? See, it's spreading. Florence, does it damage the reputation, though, if not necessarily of capitalism, then certainly of Japan, which has, of course, projected so keenly this image of itself as a great manufacturing nation? Will it cause people to think differently about brand Japan?
I'm not sure. For a while, of course, I'm not sure. Like, you see the shares are plunging down, but as for Volkswagen, like, of course, there will be some money lost in the meantime, but in the end, you know, I think it will go back to kind of not normal, but acceptance of the fact that these things happen or can happen everywhere.
I would say that Japanese friends of mine say that the reason that we're reading about all this is because Japan is a relatively honest and open society. Well, yes, and they say that if this ever happened in South Korea, no way would you ever discover it. They may have a point.
It does remind me of a conversation I had with a former MI6 officer who said that nobody spied on Japan because there wasn't any point.
That's a wonderful line. I don't know if it's true or not, but anyway.
Well, we will move along finally tonight to New Zealand, the traditional placidity of which has been rent by a row over the use of the country's indigenous language on its radio and television channels. Several high-profile presenters, some but not all of Maori descent, have taken to incorporating into their broadcasts Maori, or te reo, words or phrases, to the fury of the kind of people who can be relied upon to be infuriated by this kind of thing. TV3 weather reporter Kanoa Lloyd in particular has been a subject of umbrage for referring to New Zealand and its North and South Islands by their Maori names of Aotearoa, Tiaka Aumaui and Te Wapanumu. And I'm just looking for flinching from our Kiwi studio manager. I'm getting a shrug. What, solid 6.5, 7 out of 10 there? Okay, fine. Apologies to any Maori speakers who may currently be jamming their elbows into their ears. Florence, first of all, is there anything particularly wrong with this? If you were living in New Zealand right now, would you be writing angry letters to local newspapers?
No, because I'm not New Zealandese. But I try to imagine to transpose this in France, like in the Basque country, like if the weather report was partly in Basque, I'm sure there will be some angry listeners also.
John,
I mean, the acceptance of the local languages of the minority, I mean, people who are numerically minorities is not that easy. It's really a cultural question that has more implication than just some words. That's how I try to explain the reaction.
John, the angry people in New Zealand getting angry about this, I cannot help but notice, appear to be disproportionately white, male and beyond a certain age. They are trying, some of them, to make a thing of the fact that only 50,000 people in New Zealand are in fact fluent in the language, kind of their argument. Is that really what they're upset about, do we think?
Well, yes, it may well be. I mean, in the end, the first quality of a language is to communicate. And if you are listening to the radio and people keep saying things that you don't understand...
It's just the occasional word here and there, though.
Well, that's the way it started, but whole sentences are out now. A full disclosure, I mean, 2 points. Firstly, I am male, pale and beyond a certain age, so I suppose I fit into the cohort and might write the letters, though I assure you I don't. Secondly, I'm Welsh, and I am up to my neck in just this kind of debate. What do you do in a country where you've got two languages and there's a certain amount of ill feeling between the speakers of both? I mean, the Welsh solution has been that you run entire separate channels for people who prefer to listen to the radio or watch television, whatever, in Welsh. You don't try and mix them. If you had people on English language television in Wales throwing in Welsh phrases, you'd detonate a nuclear explosion. I mean, far more, far worse than anything we're seeing in New Zealand. But the Welsh solution does actually seem to work, and I wonder whether there might be a model there for the Kiwis.
I mean, I'm thinking, obviously, of how a similar scenario would play in my own homeland of Australia if, whoever was presenting the weather on television started throwing in the occasional phrase from an Aboriginal language. And I suspect, a similar cohort in Australia would go absolutely nuts about it, for all the fact that quite a lot of the places whose weather they would be describing are places with Aboriginal Australian place names. But Florence, for a country like Australia or New Zealand, which was founded on somebody else's territory in somewhat disreputable and shabby circumstances, to understate matters wildly, it's not a bad thing, is it, to be reminded of the indigenous language and the indigenous culture?
I guess that's why the reaction is so violent, because, as you said, the way these nations were built is a bit peculiar. What struck me in the story, actually, is rather, if the figure is accurate, the few number of people, I mean, 50,000 people speaking Maori over a population of 4.5 million, this is what surprised me. Because I was mentioning Basque Country in France, like trying to transpose. I mean, there were really efforts made in France, in the Pays Basque or in Brittany, to have people having the possibility of learning the language and really encouraging to learn this other language or the language of the other. So I'm surprised it's not more the case in New Zealand.
I was surprised by how low that figure was as well. I hope it's not incorrect. I did check that a couple of places from New Zealand sources, but that was the number I came up with, 50,000 for speaking the language fluently. But again, in a similar scenario, John, that thing where there was an indigenous people, their land was taken, should the language be kept alive? Should it be taught at schools?
Absolutely. Oh, don't get me going on this. Yes, absolutely. This is part of heritage, part of rights, and the Saxons stole our land.
What do you think, Florence? Should there be a degree of compulsion about learning to speak indigenous languages?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm half Basque, like you are Welsh, but I have this side of my family, so I also thought about it. And, compulsion, yes, at a certain level, yes, you have maybe to start with that, considering, again, that the result and the number of people speaking is so low.
The thing, while researching this, I found out about New Zealand that I did not know when I woke up this morning, is that it has three official languages. It has English, Te Reo, the Maori language. Does anyone want to take a guess at the third?
Pidgin?
Australian English?
Careful. I mean, you're going to have to think out loud a bit, because we are, of course, on the radio, and if you just sit there sort of going...
Was it supposed to indicate quotation? A wild guess. Something like Spanish?
No. I'm not quite sure how that would have happened.
No.
This is clearly going to work as a pub quiz question at some future juncture. I like this. Sign language. New Zealand sign language is an official is an official language. As far as I know, they're not the only country. I did look this up. There are other countries where the local sign language is either an official language or they're thinking about it, among them Papua New Guinea and South Africa, and I think South Korea. But those are the three official languages of New Zealand.
I just wonder, do you watch the weather forecast in New Zealand with somebody signing it rather than you do in the UK? And has that also produced hails of protest from people of my age who are male?
Oh, almost certainly. But what doesn't? What doesn't? That does bring us to the end of today's show. John Everard and Florence Biedermann, thanks for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researched by Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager and language coach was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's Section D. There's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.